are heading?
Well, I think reading, deep reading is lamentably gone. Now, deep reading now occupies a position, say, that studying ancient Greek or studying Latin might have held, 25 years ago when people were educated culturally in more traditional ways, and writing the same. I think writing is going to be more and more superficial.
So say someone today, the artist of today, they have this perspective of social activism. They have the creative urge. What should they do? Should they persist at writing, or should they get into some other field, movies, television?
What should they do to harness their activism? There are a number
and
of
their creativity.
Yeah, there are a number of subversive things they could do. Which are online, maybe I'm not supposed to say this, but hacking and so on, and that obviously takes a certain kind of creativity. As far as traditional art modes, I think there are examples, even fairly recent examples. Take AIDS and ACT UP and Grand Fury. When all the AIDS propaganda was happening in the 80s and homosexual men were demonized, they used art, ACT UP and Grand Fury, to fight back. You know, posters, occupations, theatrical responses, and so on. And I really think that were it not for ACT UP and Grand Fury, there would have been many, many more premature deaths, from HIV and AIDS than there actually were. And as it is, virtually a whole generation, was decimated. So I think in certain instances, writing and art can work now, but the instances are fewer and fewer because there's not a receptive audience out there. People simply don't pay attention to reading and writing, even in the way they did, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
We've been talking with Harold Jaffe on Between the Covers. His most recent work is the fiction collection Induced Coma, 50 and 100-word stories. I'm Ken Jones. This has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Hal for visiting us at KBOO today and for all of you for listening.
Let's defrost in a romantic mist. Let's get crossed off everybody's list.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
I'm SW Concert, and today we are spotlighting an iconic Northwest filmmaker who started out right here in Portland.
palabras que piense y declaro, madre, amigo, hermano, y luz alumbrando la ruta del alma.
So that's Joan Baez singing the Victor Jara song, Gracias a la Vida. And I'm joined in the studio right now by Walt Curtis, who is the author of Mala Noche, as well as a poet, a painter, and the occasional host.
Earth.
And the occasional host of The Talking Earth here on KBOO, full disclosure. So you're best known as a poet and a painter, but this book, this chapbook, Mala Noche, was really your big foray into narrative, kind of memoir. And
I've always been a prose writer, but go ahead. So yeah. What are you...
So from what you're telling me, the movie version of Mala Noche was barely fictionalized. It was your story.
On an adventure. I was so worried about these kids, Johnny and Pepper. They came up and then they met me in Dimitri's grocery next to Satyricon. And so I bonded with them, gave them free food, and I talked to them. And we became friends, and my Spanish was rather broken back then. But it didn't matter. So that's what you're going to see in the movie, the friendship with these two basically kids. And then what also you're going to see is a lot of the shots of the film were in my room at the old Lawn apartment. They took over my apartment, and my electric cord almost caught on fire, and I had a little gas room.
So basically, so when people go and see this film, Mala Noche, folks who haven't seen it already, folks who might be new to Portland, what they're going to see is a document of what this town was
history.
Like.
History. The book is based really on reality. It was a chapbook. I say it's based on reality. I didn't interject with there doing the acting job for the film. But what I did do was find these street people to put in the film. So you have these extraordinary people who used to come in to Dimitri's. But, you know, a grocery back then made several thousand dollars a day, and we couldn't afford it. I mean, Gus and I, he gave me $1,000. We made the film on a shoestring. And so we went down to Katrina's Deli, and we made up a dummy grocery store, a wino grocery store. But a lot of those street characters came in there, and they were watching over Johnny and Pepper. And it's very touching stuff because that era of Portland history is totally gone. All those streets have changed. The billionaires have bought up Portland, and we don't use the word gentrification. We use displacement. They own this city now. Portland will never be the same. So when you see Mala Noche, Drugstore Cowboy, or My Own Private Idaho, you're looking at an era of Portland that no longer exists and never will exist again.
Well, speaking of history, we've had Penny Allen on the show, and you first met Gus Van Sant and Eric Edwards and Hank Pender on the set of her early films, Property and Pay Dirt, where you were the lead actor. Penny, at least, claims that Gus Van Sant was working sound on property.
So Eric Edwards shot the Penny Allen films, Property and Pay Dirt. And then Gus, in the beginning, he was a sound man. And actually, Eric Edwards shot the stills for Mala Noche, and John Campbell shot the film itself. He's the farmer in the movie where we take the kids out to find them a job in the countryside.
Well, you know, this movie was not available for years and years and years, all during the 90s.
It
was not available.
Now.
Yeah, until the DVDs became popular. This movie wasn't screened anywhere for many, many years while Gus Van Sant was in Hollywood.
Again, The goddamn movie rights, we didn't do it properly. If you're a young independent filmmaker, make sure you have clearance on the music rights, okay? Because there are powerful forces out there. Every, you know, I just took stuff off the damn radio. We were playing the Beatles song, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, okay? This is serious. And so we actually put about 40 seconds of that into the film. It goes boom, boom, boom before he has the car, runs off the road. You can't do that. I mean, that's expensive stuff, the Beatles. But I thought it was so appropriate in my chapbook, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Johnny is Carnell is not around. And so it was a great early version of the film. I don't think it's in there now. Gus did. I think he got the rights back. But that's why this movie was basically suppressed. Every song, every piece of music had to be vetted and bought up.
So thank you, Walt, for coming in and talking about Mala Noche. It's playing tonight, Thursday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. It's kicking off the Essential Gus Van Sant series. It's all going to be playing at the Witzel Auditorium downstairs at the Portland Art Museum. Walt, it's great to talk to you, and we're now going to continue talking about the Gus Van Sant series with Jen Chavez. Her guest is Mario Falsetto. He's the author of the new book, Conversations with Gus Van Sant. Gracias a la vida
que me ha dado tanto. Beloved and prolific Portland-based filmmaker Gus Van Sant. The film series kicks off tonight at 7 p.m. with the thoroughly independent 1985 feature Mala Noche, which we just heard a bit about. What will follow are highlights spanning the next 23 years of Gus Van Sant's career, including his Portland trilogy, in addition to influence films by Stanley Kubrick, Werner Herzog, and others. Well, if this isn't cool and comprehensive enough for you, you're in luck. The Northwest Film Center School of Film is offering a companion course, The Essential Gus Van Sant, which kicks off Saturday. At the helm will be Mario Falsetto, Professor Emeritus of Film Studies at Concordia University, Montreal, and author of Conversations with Gus Van Sant and other books on film. The 8-week course will examine Van Sant's body of work through lectures, clips, and discussion open to filmmakers and film lovers alike. Tuition to the course includes free admission to the film series. Mario joined me recently to talk more about the upcoming screening series and his School of Film course, as well as impressions of Gus Van Sant's versatile body of work. So you are quite knowledgeable about Gus's body of work. In fact, you just put out a book that I'm looking at right now, Conversations with Gus Van Sant, which you did over the course of several interviews with him over several years of his career. As you perhaps know, Gus Van Sant is our foremost hometown hero in the film community. I know this in part from working at a local video store. I'm wondering how you think his work relates to Portland, specifically as a city, and as a setting that might be interesting to people taking your class.
My sense is when Gus started making films, and you know the Portland trilogy, Mala Noche, Drugstore Cowboy, and My Own Private Idaho, those are examples of what we would call regional filmmaking. So he, you know, I think Gus had a particular place within the American independent film scene of the late 80s and early 90s, you know, that whole kind of renaissance that happened in the 80s. And so there were all these different pockets of regional filmmaking, like Richard Linklater, Slacker. And I think it was very important at the time that people could see that you didn't have to go to New York City or Los Angeles to be a filmmaker. Obviously, for people from Portland, it was important to see their own city in movies. But for people outside of Portland, like me, that's all we knew about Portland, is what we saw in Gus's movies. I mean, basically, I knew nothing about Portland. But I saw it in Drugstore Cowboy, and I saw it in My Own Private Idaho. I think his films were important specifically because they were kind of about the Northwest, But the kind of environment that the characters were a part of in Portland could be found in any big city. He's interested in people outside the mainstream. He's interested in people who are trying to find themselves sexually, you know, in terms of identity. He's interested in all of those things that everybody goes through, whether they're living in a big city, whether they're in a small town. So I think people relate, they're related to the reality of those films.
I wonder, in your conversations with Gus Van Sant for the book you just put out, what did you learn about him or his work through that process that surprised you?
You know, I learned things about the films from him that I would never have known. For example, you know, in my own private Idaho, there is the famous campfire scene, mm-hmm. which is, you know, where Mike declares his love to Scott. And it's a very important scene. It's like almost the center of the movie emotionally. But, you know, when I read the early drafts of the screenplay, it's not clear that any of the characters are gay, for example, overtly. And Gus said that, you know, that when he wrote them, his experience of street hustlers was, you know, they were often just doing it for money, and it wasn't just really about them being gay. So River Phoenix sort of had the notion that he really wanted to make him gay, and he really wanted to have him declare his love to Scott. And that sentimentality actually kind of works against the unsentimentality of street hustling. But Gus said, that's fine. If that's how you want to take the character, I don't have a problem with that at all. That sounds great. In fact, that campfire scene is important because it's the only really positive expression of gay sexuality in the film. Otherwise, we would only be left in my own private Idaho with those horror stories at the cafe, where they're just recounting all the horrors of street hustling. So we have this really positive expression. So that kind of thing you would never know unless you sat down or unless you read an interview with a filmmaker who would tell you things like that aren't just not obvious on the screen.
So you are going to be teaching a class upcoming, as I mentioned, the Central Gus Van Sant at the Northwest Film Center.
Starts on Saturday.
Could you, yeah, please give us more details about when
the course is going to last for 8 Saturdays, and we'll try to talk about all of the work, as much of the work as we can, but obviously the focus will be on the films in the film series, as well as the influences. Some of the influences are also really interesting, so I'd like to talk about them. The influence of the avant-garde, for example, on him, or, you know, Herzog or Kubrick or Bellatar. So I will bring in material, I'll bring in clips, and so we'll have discussions. I'll do some lecturing, and so it'll be a combination of different things, so that we'll sort of try to get into Gus's world cinematically as deeply as we can within the confines of 8 classes and, you know, 2.5 hours a week. So yeah, we'll be looking at the films. There'll be some kind, you know, sometimes production history, but mostly sort of aesthetic discussions and also, you know, thinking about what the films are getting at, what the meaning is, mm-hmm. things like that. And also, I guess, the material that he has said in the interview material, we'll bring that in as well, just sort of looking at the films from his perspective as much as we can.
What are the different things that you hope perhaps a filmmaker might take away from the class, or perhaps just a viewer or a lover of cinema might take away from their class?
Well, you know, in a lot of my teaching, I've always had people making films and people just studying films. So I always find those different points of view extremely interesting and extremely important. So sometimes something will happen on the screen, and there'll be a technical question that one of us will have, and someone in the class will explain the technical issue, you know, or how it got there. But other times, I think the filmmakers gain from the perspective of people who are looking at films critically and thinking about them a bit differently than just sort of the nuts and bolts of making them. So you bring those two things together, and in a sense, that's kind of what I've tried to do a bit in some of my work by interviewing so many other filmmakers over the last couple of decades and putting out some of these interview books, is that I as a teacher of film studies teacher, my perspective has changed so much by sitting down and talking to filmmakers. I hate the notion of being in this kind of ivory tower, you know, and looking at something so cerebrally and just being divorced from the actual act, the creative act of making a film.
I'm wondering what picture you hope the selections of the film screening, both the influences and his body of work, present of him as a filmmaker.
Well, first of all, I want people to see that he has a range of work and a range of influences. So you've got European art cinema like Bellatar, you've got great American filmmakers like Kubrick, you've got experimental films like some of the people we're showing, like Brakhage and Bruce Conner and people like that. So I want people to see that Gus is not easy to pin down as an artist, and that he's interested in movies, and he loves movies, and he cares about movies, and he's a serious filmmaker, and he sees it as a serious poetic medium. I want people to be introduced to some filmmakers they may not know, to not be afraid of the avant-garde, you know, to see that, stylistic choices in a film really determine what that film is doing and what it means. I think they can see that aesthetically the range of things that a filmmaker has at their disposal is quite wide. And I think that they will hopefully have maybe a different respect for Gus's work, that it's not, oh yeah, it's My Own Private Idaho, or, you know, oh, I didn't see that film. Was it good? You know, that kind of thing. I would like to think that they would have a much better understanding of his work.
I've been speaking with Mario Falsetto, the author of Conversations with Gus Van Sant, who will be teaching a central Gus Van Sant at the Northwest Film Center. Thanks so much for joining me, Mario.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, Jen. And you're listening to The Film Show. I'm SW Concert with Jen Chavez. And right now, I am joined by the director of Thanhouser Studios and The Birth of American Cinema, documentarian Ned Thanhouser, is in the studio with us. Ned, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Ned, let's talk about your film. It's called Thanhouser Studios and the Birth of American Cinema. This is a collection of films that you dug up one by one that you originally didn't know existed, and these were all produced by your grandparents.
That's right. I had thought growing up, according to my father, that all the films that my grandparents had made back in the teens were gone. My grandfather burned all the negatives. And in 1986, I saw on television a Thanhouser film come up on a public broadcasting program. And I said, oh my gosh, there are some films that survive, because every negative that Edwin burned produced 30 or 40 prints that went into distribution. And thank goodness, archives and collectors saved some of the films. And out of the 1,000 films that they made, I found over 225 surviving prints around the globe, literally. Washington, D.C., at the Library of Congress, George Eastman House in Rochester, Museum of Modern Art in the United States, and then even over in Australia, New Zealand, Amsterdam, and in London. They have films that were distributed around the world.
Now, I saw the film in January at the Film Center, and you were playing it around town. And what it reminded me of was the story of Georges Méliès, the very early French filmmaker, whose Martin Scorsese did a fictionalized version of him called Hugo, starring Ben Kingsley. And like your grandparents, Georges Méliès had a brilliant but short-lived career. Your grandparents made films from 1909 to 1917. And Georges Méliès thought he had burned all of his films too, but folks came back later on and found prints all over the world.
Exactly. One of the most well-known films he did is called A Trip to the Moon, which was made in 1902, again about 8 years before my grandparents got involved. And A Trip to the Moon is a classic film, very well done, uses lots of stop motion tricks to introduce magical artifacts that come in. And there's even a version that's recently been restored to the original condition, which was color. It had hand-painted color on every frame. Most of the copies people see are black and white. But even my grandparents, Edwin and Gertrude, they did what was called tinting. So the films were not necessarily black and white, but they would tint sections of the film. Blue would be like nighttime. Yellow would be an interior, green would be outdoors. So it was a tint on the film.
So we all know about these silent films that came out of, say, United Artists, the Chaplin films, and such. These are independent films, though. This was a studio that sort of built up from a barn in New York, and this was during a period of time when movies were cheap to make and the talent was there. But this was an independent studio that did a lot of groundbreaking work.
Yeah, so back when my grandparents started this, they were actually in the live theater business. They've been running a theatrical company for a decade, and in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And when they finished that, they saw that the box office receipts were declining, and because of these new things called movies, and there were Nickelodeons popping up everywhere, and they moved to New York and decided to take their talents from the stage to the screen. And they renovated a abandoned roller skating rink and applied for a license with Thomas Edison for a license to use Edison's equipment. And they were denied because they had no experience. And this didn't get in their way. They became an independent, as we know today, the independents, independent movie makers. They were one of the first to do that. And in 1910, they released their first movie called The Actor's Children, which we have a copy of. And you can see it on my website, thanhauser.org. It runs 12 minutes. It was a one-reel film. And it's marvelous to watch. Again, it's a historical document that shows us life as it was back in the teens in the United States, especially on the East Coast.
Now, as you said, you thought all of these films were lost. You were very young when your grandparents died, and your dad told you, no, there are none of these that still exist. And then when back in the 80s, you know, miracle of miracles, one of these films shows up on TV, and, right. And you're off and running. This became your mission.
It did. You know, that was before the internet and before you had VHS home distribution on, you know, videotape. So you couldn't just turn on the TV and select a program. It was like whatever they decided to show you. But when I saw this one program on public broadcasting, I got on the phone and started calling archives and collectors. And I found Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde on 16mm film at Black Hawk Films. That was in the collection at Black Hawk in Des Moines, Iowa. And so I was able to acquire a copy of that and then rent the Roseway Studio here in Portland, and we screened the film to 100 of my friends.
Well, you're going to be touring the East Coast with your film, Thanhauser Studios and the Birth of American Cinema. But folks here in the Northwest can see this documentary in July on Turner Classic Movies. And also, it's going to be available streaming online on Vimeo and Fandor. And you can get the DVD also online.
Right. If you go to thanhauser.org, that's thanhauser.org, you'll find everything you need to either buy it on DVD or Blu-ray or stream it online.
Ned Thanhauser, director of Thanhauser Studios and the Birth of American Cinema, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now, Jen Chavez with the film calendar of events.
Here's a list of film events coming up in the next month. Tomorrow, April 24th, acclaimed animator Bill Plimpton will visit Cinema 21 for the Portland premiere of his newest animated feature, Cheatin'. Bill will be on hand to introduce both a 7 and 9 p.m. screening and will lead a Q&A discussion following the 7 p.m. show. More info at cinema21.org. On April 29th, McMenamin's Kennedy School will be home to Portland is Growing, a festival of local films. The city's planning bureau organized the festival to coincide with a big update of Portland's long-term urban growth plan and asked community members to submit films about how Portland is growing and changing. This collection of shorts will screen from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Details at mcmenamins.com/Kennedy School. On April 30th, Cinema Project presents its new screening, Frameless Continuum, Image Processing in Early American Video Art. The 7:30 p.m. screening at PNCA's Mediatek will feature short works from the 1970s and 1980s. More information at cinemaproject.org.
From May 4th through the 10th, the Hollywood Theater will host this year's Northwest Animation Festival. The week-long fest will showcase feature films, international short film marathons, an Oregon animation industry showcase, a variety of themed screenings, and more. Details at nwanimationfest.org. May 6th marks the entry deadline for this year's Portland Film Festival, which takes place in early September. Entries of any genre in the fiction, nonfiction, world cinema, transmedia, short, and student filmmaking categories are welcome. More information on submitting work at portlandfilmfestival.com. On May 13th, the Northwest Film Center will showcase short works by its own staff and faculty at the Movers and Makers screening. The show starts at 7 p.m. with all directors in attendance. Details at nwfilm.org. From May 14th through the 17th, Q-Doc returns for its ninth year. That's short for the Portland Queer Documentary Festival, the only fest of its kind in the U.S. Featuring works that engage core issues of queer identity, such as politics, history, culture, diversity, sexuality, family, aging, and coming out issues. More information at queerdocfest.org. On May 22nd, the Clinton Street Theater presents the newest installment of Homegrown DocFest. The 7 p.m. screening features a collection of local documentary shorts by filmmaking students of Northwest Documentary. Details at cstpdx.com. And from May 22nd through the 24th, the Filmed by Bike Festival returns to the Hollywood Theater. The fest kicks off with a street party at Velo Cult for opening night and goes on to present 50 short films that give a glimpse into bike culture.